I'm Alan Lytle with the WUKY News In-Depth Report.
Where have you been to, Lord Randall, my son? Oh, where have you been to, my sweet pretty one?
More than a century ago, Kentucky native Catherine Jackson French's research kickstarted a resurgence of Appalachian music that continues to this very day. But her collection of traditional Kentucky ballads, which should have been her crowning achievement, never saw print. My guest today has uncovered the story of why. It's an intriguing tale of academic rivalries, gender prejudice, and broken promises. Liza DiSavino is an assistant professor of music at Berea College, and she joins us now to talk about her new book, Catherine Jackson French, Kentucky's Forgotten Ballad Collector.
Catherine Jackson French was a native of London, Kentucky. She was born there in 1875. She was really a remarkable woman. She earned a PhD from Columbia University in 1906, only the second woman in the history of the college ever to do so. She came back to collect ballads in Kentucky in 1909, and then she tried to publish in 1910, but due to a real stew of intrigue that involved what was known as the Ballad Wars, which involved professional jealousies and gender roles and broken promises and outright theft, she was never able to publish her ballad collection. So she tried for 5 years. She had enlisted the help of Berea College to do so, particularly the services of William Goodell Frost. And the reason that it did not get published is this incredible tangle of conflicting interests and jealousies on the part of other collectors, and just a whole bunch of things came into play. And so because she never published her collection, people in Kentucky don't know about her.
Why do you think it was so cutthroat? And I'm talking, of course, about the ballad wars and academia in general.
Well, you just said the golden word, academia. Academia was as cutthroat in 1910 as it is now. Maybe more so. And ballad collectors were among the worst because they viewed ballads as a kind of artifact. You know, they treated them the way that an archaeologist would treat a beautiful vase that they found in the site of a Mesopotamian ruin, you know. So they were anxious to claim the ballads that they found and lend their names to them, and thus by doing so gain authenticity for themselves and gain a reputation for themselves. So careers were at stake, basically.
You're a music professor. Talk about the first time you became aware of Catherine Jackson French and the journey that has taken to bring all of this to light.
Well, I came across Catherine Jackson French quite by accident. I was researching something else totally unrelated. And I was in the Berea College archives, and the archivist Harry Rice came out with a box in his hand. And I said, "Hi, Harry." And he said, "Hi." And he said, "Have you ever heard of Catherine Jackson French?" And I said, "No." And he put the box down, and I began looking. I was intrigued right away. She was a woman of contradictions. She was a woman in academia who was interested in these old traditional ballads sung by rural people. She was a Southern woman who had gone north for her education and for the beginning of her professional life, but kept returning home. And I was intrigued by all of that, and I was doubly intrigued by the fact that she had tried to publish and had not been able to. And I wanted to untangle those knots. I wanted to discover that story. So I, as far as the journey to do so, I did what most researchers did. I went to all of the places associated with her, places that were important in her life, the Science Hill Female Academy. I went down to Shreveport, Louisiana, because she founded a women's department club there. After she gave up her ballad pursuit, she and her husband moved to Shreveport, and she was down there a good long time. I went to the Filson, I can't think of the name of it, Filson.
The Filson Historical Society in Louisville?
Yeah, thank you. Filson Historical Society, which is a mouthful when you try to say it that way. And looked up all kinds of things on Science Hill. I went to London, Kentucky to go to the Laurel County Historical Society. I was going through all of these avenues to kind of get a general picture of what the times were like in the places that she had lived. And I was doing pretty well, but the one thing I couldn't find were her descendants. I couldn't find people related to her. Until finally, I had this brainstorm, and I went to one of the online genealogy sites that give you a free week. And I was sort of broke at the time, and so what I did was I got a free week, and I looked up Catherine Jackson French and discovered where some of her descendants were. So there was one woman named Kay Tolbert Buckland. I called every Kay Buckland in the United States, and finally I hit on the right one, and I discovered Catherine Jackson French's granddaughter. And her granddaughter lived in South Carolina. I went to visit her, and she had a whole room, an entire room, from top to bottom filled with boxes, and in those boxes were letters and diaries and lesson plans and photographs and newspaper clippings, including a couple of letters from some people at Berea College that went a long way to explain why the ballads had not been published. And that central mystery is sort of the meat of this story. It is the main part of this this tale.
And we won't divulge that here because we want people to read the book.
Right.
Now, you had mentioned a stew of academic rivalries, gender prejudice, and broken promises. Can you separate one from the other, is it just the perfect maelstrom of things conspiring against this woman?
I think you hit the nail on the head. It was not any one thing that led to her denial of publication. It was a whole bunch of things operating in tandem and interacting with each other. You know, if she were a man and she had a PhD from Columbia University and she wanted to publish a ballad collection in 1910, I don't think she would have had a problem. But because she was a woman, she needed the help of a powerful man. So she enlisted the help of William Goodell Frost. And it was very promising at first, but due to a whole variety of reasons, it did not come to fruition.
And how would her research change the whole landscape of the ballad wars had it seen print?
Catherine Jackson had an entirely different bent on her view of who was singing the ballads, who was keeping them alive. If you take a look at what's kind of thought of as the Bible of Appalachian balladry, the English folk songs from the Southern Appalachians collected by Cecil Sharp and Olive Dame Campbell. When Sharp in his introduction is talking about ballad singers, he's always using the pronoun he. He's always saying, when the ballad singer sings, he closes his eyes. When the ballad singer sings, he does not show any affectations, and he and him and his all the way through his introduction. But Catherine Jackson French, she stressed the role of women, and she talked about how it was the women who were keeping these ballads alive. She said, to the women is the credit of the preservation due. And her entire take on Appalachian balladry was that women were the ones singing these old songs. They were the ones keeping them alive. These songs resonated more with them, she thought, because their lives were also hard and tragic and full of loss. So we would have had a different picture right away as to who was singing these ballads, who was keeping them alive. So that's one way. Another way is her ballads have a different makeup musically than the ones Sharp collected. Sharp goes on a long tear about how important pentatonic scales are and how that somehow proves that these were pure English ballads that hadn't been touched. Well, the fact of the matter is the likelihood that they were pentatonic in the South and not in the North and not really in England when you really take apart the collections of ballads that had been put together there, is because in the South, African Americans and to a lesser extent Native Americans interacted with the white settlers, and that had an effect on their music. Pentatonic scales are way bigger in African music and in Native American music than they were in British balladry. So it's an interesting thing that Sharp's main claim is totally backwards. And if you take a look at Jackson's collection, you'll find a whole lot of songs that are just in plain old major keys. And I may be losing some of your listeners with this wonky talk. Think of it this way. Pentatonic scales, five notes, regular major scales, like Do A Deer, seven notes all the way up. Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do. So her songs musically were really different than the ones that Sharp collected.
And obviously, your mission here is to, to introduce the world. If they hadn't heard of her yet or already, to just highlight what a person who was way ahead of her time and kind of give her due, correct?
Yeah, I wanted to give her back her place in ballad history because she had been denied that. And to at least some extent, part of that was due to William Goodell Frost. And I felt that, you know, a promise had been given to her and it hadn't been kept. So I wanted to see that promise fulfilled. And so not only does this book tell her story, but the last part of the book includes those very same ballads, finally published after 110 years. So the circle is complete. In Scarlet Town, where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling, and every youth cried, well-a-day. Her name was Barbara Allen.
Liza DiSavino, author of Catherine Jackson French, Kentucky's Forgotten Ballad Collector, available through University Press of Kentucky. She's been our guest today. I want to thank you very much for your time and continued success.
Thank you so much.
Green buds, they were swelling. Young Jimmy Grove on his deathbed.